bones began turning up in the El Paso desert, and there was almost no forensic evidence to tie them to any one suspect. But a suspect was convicted, and he's been sitting on death row ever since. Was there actually a case against the serial killer, or did the police just need to pin it on someone? This is the story of David Wood, his alleged victims, and why the state won't allow more DNA testing of the clues left behind. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here. I'm a Midwesterner who now lives in New York City, putting my writing degree to use by researching true crime cases that interest me, and hopefully you. And hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. On September 4th, 1987, a city utilities employee spotted human remains near a water well he was inspecting in the northeast El Paso, Texas desert. The bones of 2 feet and 4 fingers were sticking up out of the earth near sagebrush. Police officers were called to the scene and soon found a second body 30 feet away, buried a mere 2 feet deep like the first one. Both were decomposing, but one had clearly been there longer than the other. The body that was worse for the wear had probably been there between 3 and 6 months and belonged to a 5'2" white woman in her 20s. The other woman, who was Hispanic, had probably been there up to 3 months, and they were pretty sure they knew who one of them was. 20-year-old Karen Baker had last been seen at the Hawaiian Royale Motel on June 5th, wearing red stirrup pants, a jean jacket, and white booties. Although the body was found wearing only underwear, a pair of red pants and a denim jacket were discovered close by. In the pocket of the coat were cigarettes like the one Karen smoked. The cause of death wasn't clear. Karen's adoptive mom told the El Paso Times, "They didn't say that it was violent. They didn't say very much." They also weren't commenting on the clothes found on the other body because they wanted to make some calls first. 3 women had gone missing in El Paso in the previous 3 months, and they didn't want anyone finding out their daughter was dead in a newspaper article. By Sunday, the other body was identified as Maria Rosa Cassio, a 24-year-old who had disappeared in August. Karen's body was too decomposed to come up with a cause of death, but Maria seemed to have been strangled because her jaw was broken in 2 places. Authorities knew of no link between the women. People said Karen got into a vehicle at the motel where she was last seen, but they told different stories about what kind of vehicle it was and whether or not she had gotten into it against her will. At the age of 20, she had 3 children who were left motherless, ages 1, 3, and 4. Karen's mom said she had gone down the wrong road in life, but she had recently started to turn things around. She had moved into the motel where her adoptive grandparents lived and was going to beauty school. Karen's mom said, "I'm just thankful her bones weren't broken or she wasn't stabbed or shot. I can go home and say, maybe she wasn't hurt and was at peace." Maria made money as a waitress and stripper near Dallas, but was supposed to be enrolling in community college on August 17, 1987. She left her sister's house on August 12th to mail letters in El Paso and never made it back home to her roommate. Her 1974 Ford Gran Torino was found abandoned in the middle of the street in El Paso on August 20th. Her family thought maybe she had just had car troubles, but then they heard that her things were left behind in the car. The police planned to return to the desert to look for more bodies near hers. And on October 22nd, the El Paso Times reported that dogs had found 2 more, and the police chief said there was a possibility they were looking for a serial killer. These new bodies were found within a 30 miles of the first 2. There were 4 local teenagers still missing at the time, but investigators were concerned that these bodies might not even belong to them. The chief said, "At this time, we don't know what we have, but if these are not the people we know to be missing, can you imagine the ramifications of that?" The following day, one of the bodies was indeed identified as one of the missing girls, 15-year-old Desiree Wheatley. She was allowed to stay out past curfew at a friend's house on the last day of school and hadn't returned home in 4 months. Her mom described her as a mama's girl who loved to change clothes every 5 minutes. When she went missing, she was wearing a white t-shirt that her friends at school had signed. She was found in a plastic bag full of soil. The fourth body was identified a week later as 14-year-old Dawn Smith, who ran away from home in June. She hadn't been considered one of the four missing teenagers because she was such a habitual runaway, and she had been calling her mom now and then through August to say she was all right but wouldn't be coming home. She was also found in a plastic bag filled with soil. Now, rumors had been circulating during this time about a suspect who had reportedly been arrested days before. The papers would print these splashy headlines like, "Suspect in murders arrested," and then the article would quote the police as saying, "We have made no arrest, nor has anyone been charged with any of the four deaths." But on October 28th, police finally confirmed that they had a suspect in custody, 30-year-old David Leonard Wood. He was being called the Desert Killer. He came from a troubled home in El Paso where his parents married and then divorced twice. Friends said his mother was mentally ill and his father was a strict workaholic, and he had to spend time in many foster homes when his parents weren't together. His dad said his mom gave birth but didn't mother. He failed two grades, dropped out of high school, and couldn't pass the test that would have allowed him to join the military. He had problems with alcohol, couldn't hold down a job, and reportedly had an IQ lower than 80. He had been convicted in 1977 of having indecent liberties with a child, and then convicted again for two 1980 assaults with teenagers. But he had been paroled in January of the year the bodies were found after serving only 7 of his 20-year sentence. He was now officially being charged with an unrelated assault in July or August and a kidnapping in September. A woman said he paid her $40 for a sexual act, but then abducted her at knife point. His tan truck matched the one used to pick up the woman, and she picked him out of a lineup. Authorities weren't saying that he was the serial killer, but the assault happened right in the area where the bodies were found, so everyone kind of knew. A psychiatrist who interviewed Wood in 1980 said he laughed for no apparent reason, angered quickly, and cried without provocation. The doctor wrote, "Wood states that he started heterosexual activities at the age of 12, and he feels that he is very successful with girls." The 13-year-old he assaulted in 1980 said he attacked her out of nowhere, but he said they spent the afternoon in the park beforehand and that he wooed her and stopped his advances when she complained of discomfort. So successful with girls. He said the 19-year-old he assaulted in the same year was his girlfriend, but she said they were merely acquainted and hadn't seen each other in 8 years. So this was clearly a person suffering from delusions. He had driven the 19-year-old home and let her go after the assault back in 1980, but it's clear that he had been escalating since then. One newspaper reported that he helped pass out flyers when another local girl disappeared, and you know that it's not all that unusual for killers to insert themselves into cases. Dogs found a fifth body on November 3rd. Investigators were looking for pieces of a bullet, trauma to the bones, something that might have given an indication of how anyone other than Maria had died. All they really had was a little hair left on this skull. On November 18th, the remains were identified as Angelica Jeanette Frausto, a 17-year-old who disappeared on July 3rd. Her adopted family recognized her white shorts with purple hearts and said she would come home here and there but didn't go to school. She was a dancer at the Red Flame Bar. Her family noticed when she stopped checking in with them, but they didn't report her missing until the first bodies were found because she was so often out on her own. Her grandmother said Angie especially loved little children, but would talk to anyone, that she had a memorable laugh and a big smile. Authorities continued to search the area as David Wood prepared for trial on his assault and aggravated kidnapping charges. His lawyer asked for separate trials for each charge and a change of venue to try to find an impartial jury. They filed a motion prohibiting anyone from mentioning that he was a suspect in the Desert murders. The judge allowed for the separate trials, and no sooner had the first one started than a sixth body was found by a couple out looking for tin cans. The jury had to be sequestered. These bones were discovered a few hundred yards away from the others, and the judge didn't want the jury to hear anything that might affect this trial. Wood's victim in the case, a 27-year-old sex worker, testified that she was hitchhiking to a friend's house when Wood took her to the desert spot where the bodies were eventually found, tied her to his truck, and began digging a hole, telling her, "Don't turn around." But she said they heard voices, so he forced her back into his truck and took her to another part of the desert where he assaulted her while saying, "Tell me you're 13. He got scared off by voices again and left her there. Wood admitted to a detective in a recorded interview that he had picked up the woman, but said he hadn't assaulted her. The defense tried to argue that the victim and her sister, the key witnesses, used substances that would affect their memories, that the victim had suspiciously waited a month to report the supposed crime, and that the prosecution couldn't prove the date of the alleged assault. But the victim had been able to remember exactly where she was taken, where the bodies were later found. And the state reminded the jury that they didn't have to prove the exact date, only that it happened before the indictment and within the statute of limitations. In March 1988, the jury found Wood guilty, and because this was his fourth conviction, he was sentenced to 50 years in prison. His kidnapping charge was dropped, so he didn't have to go to trial again. The sixth body was soon identified as 23-year-old Ivy Susanna Williams, who loved motorcycles and had moved from Colorado to El Paso in 1985. She was a dancer like Maria Rosa Casio. She appeared to have been stabbed based on rips in her clothing, a nick on her shoulder blade, and a severed rib. 2 years went by as authorities worked on the case and mothers mourned their daughters who hadn't yet gotten justice. Finally, on July 13, 1990, there was enough evidence to indict Wood for the murders of the six girls and women. Trial began in Dallas in October 1992, with attorneys for the now 35-year-old Wood saying he was just a scapegoat, chosen at random because the community needed someone to be held accountable. The county medical examiner admitted that all of the autopsies were inconclusive because the bodies were more or less nothing but clothes and bones. The victim in Wood's assault case testified about how likely it was that she was supposed to be one of the murdered women. He took her to the same area of the desert where the bodies were found. He made her take off her clothes, like the other women who were found in various states of undress. He tied her to the front of his truck and started digging a hole, like the graves the women were found in. Two cellmates of Wood testified that he admitted to them that he was the killer because the women had quote-unquote messed him over. One of them said Wood tattooed over a knife tattoo he had because one of his victims had lived and could identify it. He also said that one of the women had scratched him and he was worried about what might be under her fingernails. But the defense said that DNA tests on scrapings taken from underneath the fingernails of one of the victims didn't point to Wood. Of course, the DNA had deteriorated so much that the tests were inconclusive, so they didn't point to anyone. And so many people pointed a finger at Wood. A dancer friend of Ivy's said she saw Ivy with Wood just before her disappearance. Karen Baker told an employee at the motel where she lived that she had a date with Wood before she left. Angelica Frausto was last seen with Wood on his motorcycle. Several people saw him offer a ride to Desiree Wheatley. And Rosa Maria Casio was last seen with a man who resembled him. On November 10, 1992, Wood was found guilty of capital murder after only 7 hours of jury deliberations. They convicted him of murdering Ivy Williams for sure, but they didn't have to name how many other victims they had held him accountable for. It was assumed that he killed the others because the same scheme and course of conduct was used. He was the first person convicted under Texas's new serial killer statute and was sentenced to die by lethal injection. Victim Desiree Wheatley's mom said, "It's not revenge, it's justice." His lawyer said Wood was basically convicted because of his past assault record. Wood has maintained his innocence to this day. He was scheduled to die by lethal injection in August 2009, but an appeal by his lawyers led to a last-minute stay of execution. The Supreme Court ruled against executing the mentally disabled in 2002, saying it was cruel and unjust behavior as outlined in the Constitution. Wood's defense argued that prior IQ tests showed that he was developmentally disabled, and his execution was paused while the criminal appeals court took a deeper look. The court eventually ruled against the appeal in 2014, saying that Wood's IQ tests have shown dramatically different results over the years. His lawyers had failed to show conclusively that he had a diminished mental capacity. Wood remained on death row, awaiting his next scheduled execution date. In 2010, new DNA tests were conducted on three items presented as evidence in Wood's trial: scrapings from under Angelica's fingernails, and two cuttings from clothes Dawn and Maria were wearing. Nothing could be determined from two of the tests, but the third showed that a bloodstain on Dawn's dress did not belong to Wood. His lawyers have repeatedly petitioned the Texas AG's office and the courts to test all of the evidence from the crime scene, which could include over 100 items. Prosecutors have said that this one bit of evidence wouldn't have changed the jury's decision anyway, so it doesn't matter. Basically, these were some blood droplets, not necessarily from the murderer, nor even from the time of the murder. So all of the requests for further testing have been denied. In another interesting turn of events, in the fall of 2024, a man who did time with Wood came forward and said that the cellmates who testified against Wood had been lying. He said that he had also been asked by the police to help fabricate a lie that might help their case, basically make up a false confession to give them more evidence against Wood. He remembers them saying, "We can help you if you can help us." This man refused to be part of the scheme, but he says two other men agreed, those cellmates who testified against Wood at his trial. One of them was rewarded with $13,000, and the other got his capital murder charge dismissed. Both have since died, so there's no way to find out the truth. But El Paso prosecutors did write a memo in 1990 saying that they didn't have enough evidence to charge Wood. And then these two cellmates conveniently came forward. The attorney general's office says, though, that the two men didn't know of the rewards at the time. They were doing it because they wanted to help. One of the cellmates said at trial that they actually had an incentive to not speak up, since snitches, historically, get stitches. Wood's new execution date was set for March 13, 2025. But again, just days before, another stay was granted to the now 67-year-old. The Court of Criminal Appeals didn't exactly lay out why they were halting his death again. They just listed several reasons that his lawyers had given. His defense said Wood's counsel was ineffective, that the state presented false testimony, that the state destroyed evidence, and so on. One of the eight claims the court cited is that he's actually innocent, which seems kind of funny to me. Like, wow, thank you so much for letting us know. The order simply states that the stay of execution will remain in place until the court says otherwise. There's a chance they might grant Wood a new trial. For me, the one DNA test that excludes Wood is certainly interesting, and I'm not one to take an eyewitness at their word when we know they're notoriously unreliable. But these are a lot of eyewitnesses saying they saw the missing women with Wood. And the disappearances started right when he got out of prison and stopped when he was arrested again. His former defense attorney says he was under surveillance when some of the women were killed, but I'm not sure that proves he absolutely couldn't have committed the crimes. But if you're looking for hard, fast evidence here, there's not a lot to go on. At trial, the only real forensic evidence that tied Wood to the desert gravesite were some fibers found near one of the bodies. My guess is that they came from a blanket one of the bodies was wrapped in. Because Wood's truck had been cleaned to a suspicious degree when they searched it, investigators checked his vacuum cleaner, and that same type of fiber found in the desert was found in his vacuum bag. Although, since then, the National Academy of Sciences has made it clear that this shouldn't be the only forensic analysis method used in convicting someone. Is it enough when you couple it with the circumstantial evidence against Wood? It feels to me like there's so much murkiness in this case, and the defense wants you to believe that absolutely no one on the prosecution side can be trusted, from the cops to Wood's assault victim. But I will say, one thing that really got me was how she recalled that when he was assaulting her, he said, "Tell me you're 13. Even if you think the police could have coached her to say Wood took her to where the bodies of these young women were found, that seems like a pretty specific detail for them to feed to her. Either way, it's pretty clear to me that there's enough doubt in this case that at the very least, more DNA testing of the physical evidence should be done. People need to be able to trust that the legal system is trying to find the right person, not just a person, to blame for the crime.
How can I not be angry at the corruption that put me here? How can you let people just dump cases on you and not be angry?"
I have to say, this was probably the hardest to research case I've ever covered. I've used more than 90 newspaper clippings and online articles, and I still don't know much about these ladies, the victims. I hated how so often the media described the girls and women by their profession or by the thing that would have made them easy targets. Like they were always topless dancers or runaways or troubled. I understand that they were just trying to tell nice, wholesome Texans that they didn't need to be worried about the serial killer getting to them, but these victims all had families who loved them deeply and mourn them to this day. As Desiree's mom said, "There are words for when you lose a spouse. You are either a widow or a widower. If you lose both your parents, you are an orphan. But if you lose a child, there's no term for that, other than sorry. There are still three other missing girls and women from the area who have never been found. I hope we get some answers. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.